Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
You only have one guy you listen to, and it's Trump.
Well, I listen to everybody, but I have one man whose voice sounds louder than everybody else's.
Donald Trump understood America. I mean, there was no question in my mind watching the crowds reacting to him.
Paul Manafort taking the reins of the Trump campaign.
At the end of this convention, people will say what about Donald Trump?
That he's ready to be president of the United States, and there's no reason for him to change.
Paul's done a great job.
He's under audit. When the audit is completed, he'll release his returns. We really don't know what was done by and who it was done by. As far as we're concerned, the speech is Melania's speech.
Well, first of all, he didn't encourage anybody to hack.
Look, the purpose of this convention is to do some things that haven't been done during the course of campaign.
So to be clear, Mr. Trump has no financial relationships with any Russian oligarchs.
That's what he said. That's obviously what our position is.
Breaking news from the Donald Trump campaign and another change at the top. Campaign chairman Paul Manafort resigns.
You know, Paul Manafort worked for me for a very short period of time. He worked for Ronald Reagan. He worked for Bob Dole. He worked for John McCain, or his firm did.
We do know that those property purchases and various different money transactions that he's had over the years are under heavy scrutiny from federal agents.
We're also following breaking news in the case against former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort. He just entered a plea in court in Virginia.
Manafort was working, ghostwriting an op-ed with Ukrainians and a Russian who has ties to Russian intelligence.
Paul Manafort tried to contact witnesses in his own tax fraud and lobbying case.
He has no information incriminating of the president. I know that for a fact. They can squeeze him. Paul Manafort does not know anything.
Winning isn't enough, but it's how you win and how much you win.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Paul Manafort's trial kicks off today in a U.S. district court in Alexandria, Virginia. Manafort's trial is the first trial resulting from charges brought by special counsel Robert Mueller. Manafort faces 18 counts, including allegations of tax fraud and bank fraud surrounding the more than $60 million that the former Trump campaign chairman made through his work in Ukraine. If convicted, the most serious charges can carry sentences of up to 30 years behind bars. In addition, Manafort will face a second trial in the D.C. Circuit Court this September. Andrea Bernstein is senior editor for WNYC and host of the Trump Inc. podcast, and she's in Alexandria, Virginia today for the trial. She says, while the focus is on financial crimes allegedly committed by Manafort, it may be hard to keep Russia completely out of the courtroom.
It's really interesting because both President Trump and Paul Manafort have said that this trial has nothing to do with Russia, that the alleged acts occurred long before the Trump campaign. And that's true, and it isn't true. This is not a trial for conspiring to hack into Hillary Clinton's emails. This is not a trial for conspiring to coordinate with Russia. This is a trial for tax fraud and bank fraud based on Paul Manafort's financial dealings in the Ukraine. That said, there are lots of ties.
Now, Paul Manafort is currently in jail awaiting trial. Can you tell us a little bit about his circumstances right now? And if he is found guilty, what type of sentence could he be looking at?
So this is a really interesting story because Paul Manafort was initially put on house arrest with an ankle bracelet. While he was on house arrest in D.C., he communicated with the gentleman that Mueller believes is a Russian spy about an op-ed, despite the court's ban on communicating with the press. So he got in trouble for that. Then, subsequently, while he was also on house arrest for this Virginia case, so wearing two ankle bracelets, he allegedly communicated with some of the witnesses in the case, helping them, it would seem, to get their stories straight. After he did that, the special counsel's office said this man can't be trusted. He needs to go to jail. So he is now in the city jail in Alexandria, Virginia. And he came in, actually, last week during a pretrial hearing, not wearing one of these very expensive suits. By the way, the receipts for his suits are evidence in this trial because he allegedly laundered money by buying suits at the House of Bijan, which is, its slogan is, "We are the most expensive store in the world."
That's the slogan.
That is the slogan.
Okay.
So we're used to seeing him in these fancy suits, but last week he came in a green jumpsuit, which looked like a sort of white cotton undershirt underneath. So it's a very different presentation last week when he went to court from this sort of elegant man of the world that we're used to seeing him as.
Okay, so so there's a lot happening here. You talked earlier about the Ukrainian connection, and I'd like for our listeners to understand a little bit more about that. So the money that's in question here came from the work that Manafort, and correct us if we're wrong here, was doing for a pro-Russian political party in the Ukraine. So far, right?
Correct. His client in the Ukraine, strongman Viktor Yanukovych, was very close to Putin. And in fact, there's lots of evidence that he was trying to move Ukraine closer to Putin.
Okay. What did he do with that money? Is this what he used to buy suits?
Yes.
Okay.
So what he allegedly did, according to the indictment, is he was making so much money in Ukraine, he didn't want to pay taxes on it. So the alleged scheme is that he had the money wired from Ukraine to Cyprus, which at that time had notoriously lax bank regulations. And then because there's a loophole with a lot of New York real estate that you can pay with cash, which basically means without a loan, according to the indictment, the money was wired from Cyprus to pay for a number of homes in New York City. So there's a townhouse in Brooklyn, a four-story townhouse. There is another apartment in Soho in Manhattan. There is more money that went into construction at a Hamptons estate on Long Island.
What was Paul Manafort being paid for?
It's interesting because
this is a lot of money.
So there was a lot of evidence released on Friday by Paul Manafort himself. Very, very interesting. It was a series of emails and communications with his clients in Ukraine where he was discussing strategy, was discussing speeches. He was discussing the kind of normal thing that campaign consultants discuss with their clients. And I think that what Paul Manafort was doing by issuing all this information was giving us a window into his defense, which is he was acting like a normal consultant and he was doing ordinary business. The problem for Paul Manafort is that we've seen the evidence list that Mueller has released. And in addition to all of these allegedly fraudulent bank loans and tax statements, there are things like a glimpse into his season tickets at the Yankees and his payments for his Mercedes-Benz and his payments for his Land Rover. So these were all big ticket items that he was allegedly using the purchase of these items to hide the money that he allegedly was trying to hide from the IRS. So to get the money into the United States, he was putting it directly into these expensive things. All of these, according to the indictment, are allegedly ways that Paul Manafort got money from the Ukraine into the United States.
Now, did any of that activity that he allegedly performed influence the campaign? Did any of that happen around the time that he was President Trump's campaign advisor?
Well, this is a bit of an open question. So Paul Manafort's business partner, Rick Gates, who was indicted along with him but is now cooperating with the special counsel, has potentially some information about that. We may or may not see it in this trial. The judge has said and the prosecutors have said we're not going to be talking about Russia collusion specifically. But there is one place in this trial where we know very directly the Trump campaign is coming into it. Manafort bought this four-story brownstone in Brooklyn, allegedly with his ill-gotten gains from the Ukrainian strongman. Then, when the Ukrainian strongman Viktor Yanukovych was driven out of the Ukraine, Paul Manafort still wanted money. So he went to a bank and he said, I need a $7 million loan. As a matter of fact, one of the whole reasons that we at WNYC started covering Manafort, this was way back in early 2017, right after Trump became president, and I noticed that he had a $7 million loan on this brownstone in Brooklyn. And because it's not too far from where I live, I thought, wow, that is a lot of money. That's weird. Well, we learned last week that Mueller thinks it's not only weird, but criminal, because he thinks that the owner of that bank conspired with Paul Manafort to inflate the value of what that home was worth so that Manafort could get a lot of money And the banker thought, according to Mueller, that he was going to get a job with President Trump. So there are ways in which it abuts Manafort's work on the Trump campaign, but doesn't necessarily have as its subject the actual work that he did on the Trump campaign up to now.
Mueller's team also released a list of 35 potential witnesses for the Virginia trial today. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about who we should be paying attention to as who's on that
list. So quite a few of those witnesses appear to be employees of banks, insurance companies, people that may testify as to their having reviewed a particular financial document. That seems to be the bulk of the witnesses. Rick Gates, who was the deputy campaign manager for President Trump and who ran his inaugural committee and who for a while worked at a pro-Trump political action committee, Rick Gates has pleaded guilty, is cooperating with Mueller, and is, I think, the most interesting witness on this list because not only does he allegedly know about this scheme, but obviously because he worked so closely with President Trump and with Paul Manafort. Remember, Paul Manafort resigned from the campaign. He resigned from the campaign after word just began to emerge that maybe he was getting these unkosher payments from Ukraine. There was a story in the New York Times where they had found these handwritten bank ledgers where there were notations that they had paid Manafort $12 million in cash. So that story comes out. It's right after the Republican convention. Paul Manafort officially leaves the campaign. But Rick Gates, his deputy, stays there and continues to work for the rest of it. So I think Rick Gates is the most interesting witness. There's another interesting witness, Tad Devine, a Democratic political consultant. He's worked for Ted Kennedy, worked for Bernie Sanders. He's also on the witness list. From the evidence that Paul Manafort released last week, we do see that Tad Devine was also involved in the Ukrainian political campaign. There's no allegation that he was involved in anything criminal, but it will be interesting to see how his testimony fits into this whole picture.
So we've talked sort of around Mueller here, but ultimately, what is the goal for Mueller?
Well, first and foremost, from everybody that I've spoken to who's ever worked with Bob Mueller, his goal is to prosecute crimes and get convictions. So he obviously believes there were crimes committed here. He's looking for a conviction. So that in and of itself is a goal. Now, obviously, he's involved in this wide-ranging investigation. Paul Manafort could plead guilty at any time before the jury comes back with its verdict. The longer you wait to plead guilty, the theory goes, the less good a deal you're going to get. And he has given no indication that he wants to do that. So if he is simply convicted by a jury, then he will face jail time, and there is no way of getting him to cooperate. But he has said, I've done nothing wrong here. I was acting like an ordinary businessman, and I am being prosecuted for things that were never prosecuted before.
Andrea Bernstein is senior editor for WNYC and host of the Trump Inc. podcast, and she's on the ground in Alexandria, Virginia today for the trial. Andrea, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
And be sure to check your podcast feeds later this week for a special edition of the Trump Inc. podcast on the opening statements in the Manafort trial. Since at least March 2018, the Transportation Security Administration, better known as the TSA, has been busy keeping tabs on ordinary American citizens on domestic flights. That's according to a new investigative report by the Boston Globe. The report details how federal air marshals are instructed to watch certain travelers from the moment they step in an airport to the time they land and get in a taxi through a program called Quiet Skies. And these aren't people on terrorist watch lists, and they haven't been suspected of committing any crimes. So why follow them? Joining me to talk about the program is Jonna Winter. She's the fellow with Boston Globe Spotlight team who broke the story. Jonna, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what? We're being followed? Like, when did this program start, and why are they following us?
So many questions still, honestly. But what we do know is that since March, thousands of ordinary Americans who, as you said, are suspected of no crime and are not on any terrorist watch list are being followed by teams of armed air marshals throughout the airport, on the flight, and recording everything they're doing. from what direction they're walking to what kind of phones they have to what kind of computer, what kind of case for their phone. Do they have multiple phones? Are they reading? What are they reading? Are they talking to someone? Who are they? Let's note the time on the nearest security camera and write everything they're wearing. It's a huge amount of information. It's not going anywhere outside TSA. We do not know what on earth they are doing with this information or if they have found any threat or person who through this program that makes it not a huge waste of money.
Right. So we mentioned at the top that these aren't people who are on a terrorist watch list or anyone who's been suspected of criminal activity. Is there any indication what it is that might trigger the TSA to, say, spy or follow, if you will, you or me or anybody else at the airport? What's the trigger that tells them this is
flown,
the person?
If you've been out of the country and have flown back into the U.S. since March, you're being screened for this program. So there is a huge chance that if you've traveled to Turkey, if you have visited pretty much anywhere where they think there's been terrorist activity, you're probably marked for this program.
So what kinds of things are they looking for? I mean, you mentioned a whole bunch of things that they could be, that air marshals could find, everything from your laptop to whether you use the bathroom. But are there specific indicators that they're looking for that are supposed to tip them off to something in particular?
I can't speak to what the purpose of these indicators are, but I do know that I've spoken with at least a dozen air marshals who have said that this is nonsense. And they have been directed to follow ordinary Americans and then submit back two reports. One is a minute-by-minute TikTok of everything they do. And the other one is to fill out a checklist of behavior that they have observed. And that includes sleeping on a plane, sometimes sleeping on a plane, going to the bathroom. You know, do they have a cold, penetrating stare? Do they fidget? It's frankly describes everything that I do in an airport. Do you board last? Yes, I'm running late. All of these things are noted. And honestly, you're going to have to refer to TSA about whether that does any good or finds anyone.
We're talking about the TSA surveillance program called Quiet Skies. And I'm speaking with Boston Globe Spotlight fellow Jonna Winter about this. Jonna, when you talk to the air marshals, were they concerned that they were collecting information that potentially they shouldn't be? Or did they find that this was pretty much standard practice?
I have to say that, I mean, I've written about TSA and air marshals in the past many years ago. It is rare, and within even other agencies, for this many people to come forward who are directly involved in a program to all say basically the same thing, that this program is a way that they have used in the past to follow terror suspects who are actively under investigation by the FBI. They have filled out these same behavior reports and activity reports, exactly what they're doing with Quiet Skies, but they have sent them back to the case agents. So right now they're saying, what are we doing? Why are we following people? Why are we following a Southwest flight attendant who is literally working the flight because she has suspicious travel patterns? Because that's her job.
And those suspicious travel patterns are specifically for, you mentioned Turkey. Are there any other countries that are honing in, that these folks are honing in on, that people can be aware if they're traveling from or to these countries that they should perhaps be aware that they might be watched?
The guidelines that they've been providing via the documents that we've obtained and frankly through the air marshals who are carrying out this program and who have been asking for answers inside the agency, we know that Turkey is one of the reasons that many have been given for following certain people. But we don't know the others. The vague guidelines say if you've been to one or more certain countries for certain amounts of time. And there's so few resources and so few people within the Air Marshal Service that every time they are put on a plane to follow someone just because they have been to Turkey, they are pulled off a flight that they were already placed on because it was deemed a higher risk. So this is also a concern in terms of the national security element, which is why we have both sides of the aisle and everyone in between outraged.
So our team did reach out to the TSA and the Government Accountability Office for comment. The Government Accountability Office then referred us back to the TSA, and we've heard nothing from them yet. But did the TSA specifically address anything when you asked them about this program?
For the first article prior to publishing our first story on Sunday, which revealed the existence of this program, they wouldn't even acknowledge it existed. They just generally defended, all of TSA. Since then, I spoke again with the spokesman yesterday, and they've been a little bit more forthcoming and have given sort of times and dates, but unable to provide any instance where a threat was in any way identified or even one reason why this program should be there. And what's interesting, particularly in this current climate, is that there's been outrage from both sides of the aisle. If there's one bipartisan thing, it's that TSA is doing something that sounds completely ridiculous. And there are four committees that have oversight over TSA, and they have all been demanding answers to questions about this program since we first published our story exposing it. So they've called TSA to the Hill, and today and tomorrow, TSA will be briefing the four committees who have oversight.
We did reach out to members of Congress on this issue, and we heard from Congressman Benny Thompson, who's a Democrat from Mississippi, and he said he would, quote, "We'll be doing oversight on this issue, so we'll wait and see what that means." Jonna Winter, Boston Globe Spotlight Fellow, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
4 years ago, the United Nations announced an ambitious plan to end the AIDS epidemic by 2030. And so far, there's been some important progress. According to a report released by UNAIDS last week during the International AIDS Conference in Amsterdam, the number of global AIDS-related deaths is the lowest this century, with fewer than 1 million people dying each year. I spoke with senior science advisor for UNAIDS, Dr. Peter Godfrey Fawcett, about how far we've come and what's still left to do.
I think we've made huge progress in some parts of the world and in some regions. So the biggest gains have been in the places where actually the epidemic was at its most fierce, in southern and east Africa. The way we measure the epidemic really is in reducing the new infections and reducing the deaths, and finally reducing the stigma and discrimination, because HIV is still an infection that is most common amongst groups that are marginalized at the edges of society, often in many countries criminalized, discriminated against, and that proves one of the biggest challenges for making an impact on new HIV infections.
The organization UNAIDS says it has the goal of ending this epidemic by 2030. It sounds like we have made a significant amount of progress. Is eradicating AIDS by 2030 still feasible?
We mustn't underplay the successes that have been achieved. I think it's really one of the greatest achievements of public health in recent years. Having said that, there is absolutely no room for complacency. We know how to reduce HIV, but unfortunately, many administrations, many governments don't really want to engage with the people on the edges of society. So, for instance, here I'm speaking to you from Geneva in Switzerland, and amongst people who use drugs in Switzerland, in Geneva, we never see HIV. HIV doesn't occur. And the reason for that is because people who use drugs are given harm reduction, they're given clean needles, if necessary, they're given substitution therapy. Move to parts of the world where drug use is criminalized, where harm reduction programs don't exist, and you rapidly see outbreaks of HIV, such as you had in the US, in fact, in Ohio, and in other parts of the world, huge epidemics of ongoing transmission, which, if there's real political will, they could be turned off. HIV could be eradicated from drug-using populations, really by a political decision to do so.
President Trump has proposed to cut almost $1 billion from PEPFAR, which is the U.S. government's program that was started by President Bush in 2003. What impact do you think that could have, $1 billion in cuts from the United States?
I think it's a very serious question and a serious challenge to the HIV response. There's no doubt that PEPFAR has been an enormous benefit to millions of people predominantly in sub-Saharan Africa. Equally, I think it is important that we continue to push so that the HIV response doesn't only rely on American dollars. The US has been the country that has produced more support for the HIV response than any of the other international development partners. And so there are many countries that need to step up to the plate and do more.
What would you say is the biggest obstacle for both UNAIDS and other advocates to fight the spread of HIV/AIDS?
So I think that the two, if I'm allowed to take two biggest things, one is that we do need increased funding. And the second major issue is the political commitment, that we mustn't lose the political drive to change the world. We have to imagine the world in which we wish to live and have the political power to push towards that world, a world that could reduce HIV to history eventually.
Peter Godfrey Fawcett is the Senior Science Advisor for UNAIDS. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Great. Thanks very much indeed.
For Trump country, is the damage already done?
This Democrat to win in this part of Trump country.
That is Trump country, and I think the pain is going to start filtering up.
What you might call Trump country, we're talking North Dakota.
This is a state, West Virginia, that really is the heart of Trump country.
That's not Trump country.
It's been almost 2 years since the presidential election, when the media's fixation on the idea of so-called Trump country began. But when it comes to the intersection of race and class and politics, what are we still getting wrong? I put that question to Sarah Smarsh. She's a journalist born and raised on a farm in Kansas, and she recently wrote an op-ed for the New York Times called "Liberal Blind Spots Are Hiding the Truth About Trump Country."
The point of my piece was to challenge this concept that there is this broad swath of the country that is monolithically conservative in politics and culture. So while, you know, there have been some sort of fashionable and controversial calls for empathy or compassion for people with far-right views or Trump supporters, I'm far less interested in that than I am in shining a light on the millions of people, and that's working class and all classes of people of all colors, who are not Trump supporters, who have been kind of rendered invisible by the way that we create this map of red and blue squares and this electoral college that leads to very reductive media narratives about red and blue America, Trump country, and the more liberal locations. It's much more complicated than that, of course. And in places like Kansas, which is thought of as deep red, you know, in the 2016 presidential election, I think it was like 36% of voters voted for Hillary Clinton. So they are just suddenly wiped off the map when then we discuss who won the state. But 30 to 40% of Americans at all socioeconomic rungs and all colors in red states ain't nothing.
You talk a lot about your father in the piece. Tell us a little bit about him and why you decided to include his story.
Yeah, well, I guess my father kind of exemplifies my family. He's a lifelong construction worker, a white man who has rural roots. He grew up on a farm, and he's now a traveling construction worker based in Wichita, Kansas. By and large, his views correlate with, I would say, like the left wing of the Democratic Party right now. Now, he is a guy who, over the years, I'm sure has fluctuated in and out of also some conservative elements of thinking. Rural America has a deep strain of awareness about government, or quote-unquote big government. And that's a kind of old-fashioned strain in that realm of American politics that doesn't have to or doesn't necessarily intersect with the really toxic, racist, xenophobic social conservatism that we see rising today. So,
which has been the real focus. And in fact, it's been a struggle to get the media to really call some of the more abhorrent behavior that we're seeing what it is, right? Racist or xenophobic or what have you. At the same time, I guess I wonder what your thoughts are on this. It feels as though the media has covered the white working class, and I'm putting that in quotes as well, but they're only covering the white working class when it reflects the worst of society. Is that part of your argument?
I think that maybe just at the human level, members of the media who are also members of this society, like the rest of the country, seeks to find a clear villain, like who did this? Who put this guy in office? And from my vantage, it was white people. That's the answer. And it was white people at every socioeconomic rung. Where the class and the classism comes into this discussion is that suddenly, you know, within that group, the piece of it that doesn't have a voice, that can't speak for itself, is the working class and those in poverty. And they have just sort of been scapegoated, I guess.
Now, there are a lot of people who will probably read the piece or listen to this segment and will say, and these numbers are necessarily true, across the board, white Americans, whether they're poor, working class, middle class, will often and almost always in every measure of society do better than Black Americans and largely than Latino Americans. So how do you see being able to change the perception of poor whites when they still seem to be benefiting more than poor Black and brown Americans?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing is there's no denying that they benefit more than Black and brown Americans. And two things can be true at once. You know, so I, growing up in poverty, working in fields and doing manual labor growing up, I at once was economically disadvantaged and also racially privileged. And so absolutely owning and admitting that the very clear fact in this country that the fact that I'm a white person benefited me probably in ways that I will never even know.
What are the media missing when they continue to focus on the white working class in this sort of myopic view?
That narrative is destructive for all of us as Americans, regardless of where we live, in that that story allows the perfectly well-educated, well-informed, middle and upper-class white Americans who voted for him in droves to just basically get off scot-free. I mean, and it's mind-boggling to me that we see news stories of, you know, Los Angeles, New York City, attorneys, professors, white people who have every privilege in the world caught berating people of color in public or on a train or calling the cops because they were barbecuing while Black. It's like we see those stories, and yet the narrative is so entrenched that Bubba out in the country is the last bastion of racism in this country that it's like cognitive dissonance in media discourse. I feel like, yeah, I'm pushing back against this narrative out of wanting to just provide a corrective for the sake of accuracy as a journalist, but also because you're undermining progress and that movement in this country if you are invalidating or ignoring or denying the hard work on the ground fighting white supremacy, misogyny, homophobia, all sorts of elements of that have taken hold at the state level in a lot of these states that we call red. People in places like where I'm from have been resisting, quote unquote, for years. And, you know, frankly, I think it's just like that work is some of the most crucial and brave within the movement in many ways for being a political minority.
Sarah Smarch is a writer, and her forthcoming book is called Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Sarah, thanks for your insights.
Thank you so much for having me.
This week on The Takeaway, we're talking about the intersection of race, place, and health. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation says that African Americans are less healthy than white Americans in all 50 states, and it's a problem that starts at a very young age.
We saw that African American babies were being born at a higher rate of low birth weight in every single state in the nation than the counties in their state that had the worst rate.
That's Julie Willems Van Dyke from the University of Wisconsin. I spoke to her about African American babies being born underweight, which can sometimes lead to death in infancy. Priska Neely is a senior reporter covering early childhood at KPCC, and she's also been looking closely at this gap between Black and white babies. But many of the Black women she's talked to in her reporting are often unaware that their stories are part of a larger national narrative of race and health.
I did not know about it at all.
I just kind of stumbled on it, and it shocked me too.
I learned about it in a very personal way with loss of my first baby.
And it wasn't until after it happened to me that people in my family started coming out the woodwork. I lost a baby. I lost two babies.
I just wasn't aware. I didn't know. And I'm an African-American woman, and it's sad because obviously the information isn't getting out there.
The numbers from this year's County Health Rankings Key Findings Report may shed some light on the crisis facing Black babies across the country. But this isn't a new problem. I asked Priska about why there's been such a slow response to such a serious problem.
In my reporting, I found a 1984 congressional hearing, a transcript, and it was called Failure to Close the Black-White Gap in Infant Mortality. That's more than 30 years ago. So this is something that is happening to thousands of Black women across the country every year, but most of them don't realize that their personal pain, their tragedy, is part of this national narrative.
Tell us what that narrative is and how it connects to what we're seeing in the data.
Yes. So one of the mothers that I spoke to in my reporting, her name is Raina Granberry, and she lost her first baby. And she really talks about the trauma of going through that experience.
The physical act of like pushing out the baby and hearing no tears, having no baby to keep, ended up being way more traumatic than I thought it would be. And I just went into a depression. The grief was eating me up. Then guilt was eating me up because I'm like, this whole time I knew something was wrong. And I continued to let this person tell me that nothing was wrong with me.
So she went into labor just about 6 months into her pregnancy. She'd been complaining for weeks about some spotting that she was experiencing, about pain, and was repeatedly told by different doctors that, you know, it was nothing to be concerned about. One thing that's really interesting is that until this happened to her, and she didn't know that this was going on in her family. She didn't know that this is something that had touched her aunts or stepmom until she started talking about it. Because it's a, you know, it's a really unpleasant thing to talk about.
Well, it's unpleasant, but it also is something that can be considered shameful, particularly, I think, for Black and brown women who are expected to not have issues with fertility or issues with childbirth. But I'm also wondering if Raina was dismissed because of who she was as a Black woman. It might have played into how her doctors just kind of ignored her pain.
Absolutely. And one of the things that's really, you know, important to reinforce with this statistic is that it's not a matter of income or education. There have been a lot of studies done on this. A Black woman with a college degree is more likely to lose her baby than a white woman who did not complete high school. Raina is one of these college-educated women. She was about 28 when she was pregnant. She had a partner. She had a job. She sought out what she thought was a hospital in a better part of town, but she was dismissed.
One thing that specifically stands out to me when it comes to people of color, particularly women of color, is this idea of chronic stress. Talk to us a little bit about what chronic stress is and how it manifests itself for Black women in particular.
Yeah, when we look at the evolution of how, you know, this issue of Black infant mortality has been addressed over the decades, it really started with blaming Black women for individual behavior. You know, smoking or whatever it may be, that did not explain this gap in birth outcomes. Then people started to look at, okay, is it a genetic issue? But one thing we know is that African women who come to the United States, have babies here, their birth outcomes are more like white women. So it's really something about the experience of living in the United States as a Black woman. And researchers are now focused on the social determinants of health. How does your experience walking through the world over the course of your life, how does that affect the next generation? So when we look at the chronic stress, there's a term that's called weathering, and that's what researchers use to refer to how the social and environmental factors can cause chronic stress that leads to the deterioration of health as Black women age.
And we know that, you know, mentioned smoking, for example. It's no secret that smoking is not good for you. We talk about wearing seatbelts. We talk about being careful on the road. And I mean, there are just so many public health crises that we as a country have decided are important. Why do you think this is still something that is sort of on the margins, I think, of a lot of people's awareness when it comes to public health?
So first, there was just this lack of understanding. No one understood what was going on because individual behavior didn't explain it. But now that it's like, okay, it's the experience of being a Black woman, it's the life course, you know, how do you tackle that? So here in LA County, the rates are even higher than the national rate. Black babies are three times as likely to die in their first year of life. So there's some new leadership in the public health department. And Dr. Barbara Ferrer came from Massachusetts. She looked at the data, was really alarmed. And she told me that that's something that's really hard for people to talk about.
I would say this is a very blatant example of the impact of racism. And in this country, that's a conversation many people are not willing to have.
And she says it's because this is a conversation about, you know, oppression, about white privilege, about marginalization, and that's hard to talk about.
What is it that Black women, women of color more broadly, can do to mitigate some of these health issues that we're seeing?
Yeah, so I think first, awareness. It's really hard to tackle something when you don't know about it. But then we talk about this is chronic stress. You know, this statistic is stressful. It makes you even more stressed. So one thing is just really having that support, seeking out spaces to be supported by other Black moms and making sure that you're really taking care of yourself. Centering pregnancy is something that people are talking about more, which is about different programs that try to remove social isolation for Black women and try to create groups of support. But just talking to your doctor. A lot of times when women go through something terrible, they're like, I wish that I had known about this so that I could have advocated for myself in the doctor's office. So I think that awareness and advocacy for yourself are where we can start.
Priska Neely is a senior reporter covering early childhood at KPCC. Thanks, Priska.
Thanks so much.
And we've been hearing from you, our listeners, on the connection between where you live and your health outcomes.
This is Julie Harrell in Erie, Colorado. We live in Colorado with lots of access to outdoor and indoor activities. The local communities also prioritize open space, bike and jogging trails, and neighborhood recreational centers. We are one of the healthiest states, and it makes a whole lot easier to stay fit and healthy when the community as a whole supports that lifestyle.
Paul here in Vallejo, California. We are close by three oil refineries. Our air, even given usual westerly prevailing winds, is heavy in particulates. I have been diagnosed with myelodysplastic syndrome, which is linked to benzene, which is a byproduct of the refinery process. Can't draw a straight line from one thing to the other, but there it is.
This is Nikki Muhammad Fauzi from Arlington, Texas. Our younger children are covered by Medicaid, but the older ones are not because Texas did not expand Medicaid. We are under the poverty level and are ineligible for discounts on health markets.
Does where you live impact your health? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway to weigh in. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.